Winter's beauty comes with a chilling edge. From snow-covered peaks to avalanche-prone slopes, the forces of nature can turn deadly in seconds. In this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, we focus on avalanches, looking at how these icy giants form and what we can do to stay safe in avalanche-prone areas. Hey everyone, I'm Dr. Hurricane Hal Needham, host of the GeoTrek podcast. Welcome to a brand new season of the podcast where we tell stories of extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. Whether you're tuning in from the road, at home, or out on the trail, get ready for a season packed with exciting insights and actionable stories that bring you closer to the forces shaping our planet. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and join the conversation on your favorite listening platform. On this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, we explore avalanches, investigating how they form, what the impacts are, and what we can do to protect ourselves in avalanche country. We also look at insights to help with avalanche education and outreach, and how communities adapt building plans depending on avalanche risk. We are featuring an interview with Simon Troutman, director of the National Avalanche Center. Simon, thanks so much for taking time to join us on the GeoTrek podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Simon, so avalanche forecasting is a very specialized niche where you're involving many different angles of science. Tell us a little bit about how you really got involved in that area of science and what your path was to get there.
I like to be in the mountains and I like to ski. And when I was a younger man, I got myself caught in a couple avalanches and got interested in them because of that. I was lucky and I didn't get hurt too bad. And I started learning as much as I could about them and ended up doing a couple different projects. I was a geology undergrad, Western Washington University. So I did some work on avalanches there, and it was interesting enough to me that I ended up going to graduate school at Montana State University to study wet snow avalanches. And once I finished up with that, I started working in the industry, and somehow it's been 25 years.
Simon, so how many avalanche forecasters are there in the United States, and how is this organized? Are they all with one organization? Are they scattered among different entities? How does that look?
That's a good question. There's different kinds of avalanche forecasters. There's folks that forecast avalanches at ski areas. There's folks that forecast avalanches along roadways. And then there are also, you know, mines, different industrial applications. But generally, when people hear the word avalanche forecaster in terms of the public, they think about public avalanche forecasters that do backcountry forecasts for recreators. And there are about 85 of those people in the United States. And most of them work either for the U.S. Forest Service, which is where I work, or for the state of Colorado.
Interesting. So it seems like some different entities obviously engage in the same area of science, but maybe some different applications of how it actually plays out, right?
Absolutely. Yep. So it all depends on what scale you're forecasting for. And as you can imagine, whether you're forecasting for one particular slope or an entire mountain range, there's a very different methodology and a very different product.
Simon, avalanches are really these multidimensional hazards that involve many different factors and conditions. Could you walk us through really what sets the stage to get an avalanche?
Well, you need mountains, so you need steep slopes, and you need snow. So we're talking about snow avalanches here. You can also have other kinds of avalanches like rocks and soil, but what I work on is snow avalanches. So you need big steep slopes, and you need snow. And then you need that snow to be stratified in a way that makes it unstable. And that's kind of the key thing, is that if the snow is very well, very homogeneous, very well graded top to bottom, you're probably not going to have an avalanche problem. But if you have layers in that snowpack where you have a very weak layer underneath a stronger, denser layer, then potentially have a problem.
Simon, so what can produce a weak layer in the snow?
Generally, either metamorphism through time. So if you get some snow on the ground and then you have very cold, clear nights, the crystalline structure will actually change and become very weak and poorly bonded. You can also create weak layers with the introduction of water into the snowpack. So at the end of the day, there's several scenarios, but the most important thing is weak layers under strong layers can create problems.
I talked to a backcountry guide one time who said one way to think of it is once it starts snowing, you want it to keep snowing. He was always concerned if it snowed a bunch and then it just was dry, right, for 4 or 5 weeks. He felt like that can make some of those top layers weaker and susceptible. If you get another dump, then there could be avalanches. Is that kind of a good way to think about that in a sense?
In general. I think that, you know, weather is truly the architect of the snowpack. And so, yeah, every season's different and every day is different. And small perturbations in weather can have big ramifications for avalanche activity. And so, but yes, in general, if you have cold, dry periods with snow on the ground, and then you have a warmer, wetter period where it snows on top of that older, colder, drier snow, that's a really good recipe for an instability, especially if you add a little bit of wind or maybe some other factors.
Simon, let's walk through what someone can do to protect themselves from avalanches. Imagine someone wakes up in one of the big cities out west, maybe Salt Lake City or Reno, Nevada, whatever. They're going to go up in the high slope. So it's going to be a two-part question. Number one, what can they do before they even leave home the day that they're going out? Like, how can they know about avalanche risk? Where could they get avalanche forecasts? That's the first part of the question. And then secondly, we'll talk about some things they can take with them or prepare once they're out there. But let's start with planning your trip. I mean, how can you find out about avalanche risk? Where is avalanche risk and avalanche forecast? Where is that communicated?
I think even before planning for a particular trip, I think just being aware is the number one most important thing. And there's a training curriculum in the United States that goes from awareness up to avalanche rescue. But so there's a level one recreational and a level two recreational class that you can take. But the most important thing is just to know that avalanches occur in the landscape, and that, to your point, knowing about what the hazard are day to day to day, you know, simply by knowing whether the hazard is high or low, you can make better decisions. And so much of what we do is we provide that day to day analysis during the winter in heavily used populated areas. And we provide these avalanche forecasts that start out with a hazard level. And there's five hazard levels. But so to get that, you go to avalanche.org, and if you land on that website, there's a variety of resources there. But the single most important one is what we call the National Avalanche Danger Map. And it's an interactive map. And if you click through to the area that you want to go, it will give you that day's avalanche forecast.
You know, that's really interesting, Simon. I thought it was interesting, too, that you mentioned starting with awareness, right? Because with increasing air travel, people flying to, say, ski resorts from Florida or New York or wherever, right? You're probably bringing a lot of people in that may not even, like, avalanches may not even be on their radar at all, right? That they even exist, right?
Yep, that is correct. And I think even places, you know, there's mountainous areas in the U.S. where the communities are very aware of avalanches and they live with them day to day. But most of us, even if we know about avalanches, most of us don't have the time and the experience to actually follow that day-to-day dynamism, that change in hazard through time. And that's really the job of the avalanche forecaster, is to just have their head in the snow and in the clouds all winter long and have a good idea of, you know, what the hazard level is, and to try and communicate that the best we can day to day.
Simon, so how does that relate? So someone sees an avalanche forecast, how can that tie in then to their decision-making, maybe to change where they're going or to change their activities on the landscape?
I think in a very simple sense, you know, the scale speaks for itself. It starts, it's color-coded, and it starts out from, you know, it goes from green to yellow to orange to red to black. And so you can imagine it's kind of intuitive. Like if you're in the black, you don't want to go outside that day. And frankly, even when it's red, you don't want to go outside.
Sure.
When it's green, it's a pretty good bet that avalanche hazard is low and it's not your problem, but that doesn't mean that like there's mountains and so there's never no risk, if that makes
sure,
sense.
Sure.
But I think the main thing is like there's an ascending scale, and based on that scale, there's very specific ideas around how to maneuver and travel in the mountains based on the scale.
Sure.
To try and communicate that day to day.
Simon, offline, you mentioned that avalanches are different than other hazards. I mean, a person can get caught up in a flood, for example, but they're probably not creating the flood. With avalanches, you mentioned a lot of times they are triggered from people, and a fair number of those fatalities are people that actually die in an avalanche they set off. I mean, could you explain that a little bit to us? And also, you sent us a photograph of a snowboarder. Jeremiah, maybe if you can pop that up. I think that's really interesting to get a look at that and maybe talk through this photo.
Yeah, I think you know the point is really good, and it's actually one of the more interesting things about avalanches is that they are a natural hazard that people can trigger in the moment, in the situation. You know, we have natural avalanche cycles, and there are avalanches all the time that occur without humans present, but most people that die in avalanches, either they or someone in their party triggered that avalanche. And so it is very different from like a flood or a tornado or a hurricane or even a landslide, where humans are choosing to go into these areas, and they're choosing to go places where there is a hazard that they can trigger. And so it's, you know, it hasn't always been this way in our history, but it is today that you know, more than 99% of the avalanche fatalities in the United States and North America are recreationally based. Like, people are choosing the exposure.
That's interesting. Is there a statistic on how many of those were triggered by people? I mean, are most of those triggered by the snowboarder or the skier, for example?
Yes, the vast majority were triggered by either the person that was killed or someone in their party. Yes.
Simon, let's drill down into this photo we're looking at right now. We have a snowboarder, and we can see there's a huge slide that extends from above them to below them. They seem to be kind of in the middle of it. I mean, what can that person do in that moment when they realize they're in a slide?
Well, the first thing to say is that actually isn't huge. That's just a good old fashioned small to medium sized avalanche, if you can believe that.
And wow.
So that is a really important thing, which is, almost all avalanches are big compared to people, and snow weighs a tremendous amount. And when it's moving fast down a mountain, it's incredibly powerful. And so if you look at a landscape and you see big mountains with large tracks and paths without trees below those big mountains, the reason there's no trees there is because the snow is knocking them down year in and year out. So in terms of your question, what can this person do? Hopefully not get there in the first place. And that's what an avalanche forecast and good decision making is all about. If you do get in that position, you got to do everything you can not to get caught in that snow. And so in this case, he's already moving really fast. And so hopefully he just keeps moving off of that plate of snow and gets out and around the corner before it really builds up a head of steam. If he gets caught in it and starts to get trundled around, the best thing you can do is try and grab onto something and let the snow go by you. But the truth is, if you get into the position this person's in, all bets are off, and you really got to hope that you're wearing a beacon and that you have partners and friends that know how to use their rescue gear and that they can come and find you after you get buried, which is a really scary spot to be in, and you just don't want to get there.
Simon, can you explain a little bit of how these beacons work?
Yeah, they basically send a radio signal, and you need another beak. So they send and they transmit. And so in order for one to work, if you need to have somebody else that's not caught in the avalanche that has a beacon that can pick up your signal and come and find you. So one of the tenets of moving through avalanche terrain safely is to only expose one person at a time.
supposedly digging someone out, something like this. I've seen, you know, before about like small shovels that have telescopic handles and different things like that. I mean, what do you recommend that someone takes with them if they're out with a group, say in the backcountry?
We always recommend that people travel with what we call an avalanche transceiver, which is the send-receive device we talked about. An avalanche shovel, which, as you say, is a small but highly specialized and strong lightweight shovel that you can use to move a lot of snow if you need to. And then a probe, which is a collapsible probe that you can use to pinpoint the victim once you get on top of them. So as you can imagine, it's a three-part process. You use your beacon to find the person, but it's only going to get you so close. You use the probe then to pinpoint the person. And once you have the person pinpointed, then you use the shovel to remove enough snow to get them out of the hole, which is actually quite a process.
Sure. Simon, I'd imagine one of the main concerns is suffocation under all this snow. Are there sometimes air pockets? I mean, can people survive for extended periods of time under the snow, or does it typically tend to compact around them, or does that depend on the type of snow?
It really depends on the type of snow and the scenario. That said, in most cases, and in general, people typically have about 15 minutes to survive, and their survival rate drops dramatically and precipitously after about 15 minutes. And so, you know, carrying the gear is foundational. It's super important, but as important is knowing how to use it. If you don't know how to use your gear, if you don't know how to find somebody, if you don't know how to move through terrain, it's pretty tall order to get somebody out in time.
Simon, we typically think of snowboarders, skiers with a high avalanche risk, but there's also problems with snowmobilers. And you and I were chatting, you mentioned after around the year 2000, we saw a lot more snowmobile fatalities and people in harm's way. I mean, what changed around the turn of the last century that put more people at risk on a snowmobile?
It's mostly access to better machines. So as technology gets better, you know, pre-2000-ish, you know, give or take a little bit, you had to be quite remarkable on a machine to get into, like, truly get up into avalanche terrain. And so it's one thing to, you know, drive along the bottom of an avalanche path. It's another thing to take a machine up into the start zones. And as machines get better, and they have gotten much, much, much better, it makes it that much easier for people to really access the more dangerous areas. And, you know, because they're motorized, you can cover a lot of ground too. And so it's, if you can ride a machine fairly well and get up into the steep areas, it's quite easy to expose yourself to avalanches.
So in a sense, the improved technology to make snowmobiles and snow machines better is enabling people to get out into some of these more remote areas or steeper terrain that they maybe would not have likely done maybe 40, 50 years ago, something like that.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think you could say the same thing, honestly, about skis and snowboards as well. And just clothing and gear in general. Like our clothing is a fraction of the weight it was 50 years ago. It's twice as warm, and our skis work better and our snowmobiles work better. And we have all these communication devices that we can, you know, use to facilitate where we're going. And so technology is really the reason that the exposure has gone way up. Technology combined with more people. There's a larger population in the Mountain West.
You know, it's interesting, Simon. I lived for a while in Colorado, and I would go up sometimes on weekends to Wyoming, in southeast Wyoming, there by the Snowy Mountains, sometimes called the Medicine Bow Mountains, west of Laramie. And there used to be a ton of snowmobilers that came out of, say, Nebraska, Iowa. A lot of these farmers would come out, say, mid to late March before they had to go home and do planning. And there'd be tons and tons of snowmobilers out there. You were mentioning that some of these communities that bring in tons of snowmobilers are better for education than others. And you mentioned particularly, I think it was Cook City, Montana, had a really good setup for education. What about that location made it really good for educating snowmobilers?
Well, I think like we talked about earlier, you know, awareness is the single best starting point. Is you just have to be aware of a hazard to figure out how to manage yourself or make better decisions, right? And so in mountain towns, where you have relatively small populations and the avalanche centers and avalanche forecasters have a fairly high profile, it's not foolproof, but it's easy to communicate with the population at risk. In some of these places like Cook City or the Snowy Range, where you have quite a large and diverse population of people coming from the flatlands to come and ride in the mountains, they don't necessarily even know that there is an avalanche forecast available, and they don't know that avalanche forecasters have a platform to speak to communities. And so the fabric or the landscape and the geography of these places, it turns out, really matters. So for example, in Cook City, it's the end in the wintertime, it's the end of a dead end road. And so by default, you kind of have a captive population there. So you can use signage and you can use outreach with different vendors and different guiding services and different, places that people stay. You can use all three of those things to figure out ways to interact with the people that are coming into that community to ride. The Snowy Range is different because it's not a dead end road and it's a vast, wide open landscape. And you can get into Laramie from four or five different places, and you could even go riding without going through Laramie, you know? And so it's much harder to figure out how to connect with the people that are just coming in for the weekend to ride.
That's interesting. And it sounds like that's great. And it sounds like you're saying there really is this need for engagement and awareness. A lot of folks, South Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota, they're maybe riding for several months every winter on the big farms and, you know, open land. But like you said, they're flatlanders. They maybe have a lot of experience on a snowmobile, but they haven't really been on the steep terrain. I'd imagine that's where the awareness and education comes in, right?
Yep. It's fundamental.
Yeah, no, that's fabulous and really interesting how the different settings can impact your ability to do education and outreach. Well, hey, GeoTrackers, we're introducing a new segment to the podcast in 2025. It's called the Weathered Wisdom segment. So for this segment, we're going to ask every guest to share a story or lesson they've learned from weather that left a lasting impression, whether it's a moment of survival, discovery, or reflection. So Simon, when you think back at your years and decades in the backcountry with big snow, with avalanches, what stands out to you as far as weathered wisdom, stuff that's left an impression on you from what you've seen and experienced?
I feel like much of my whole job is thinking about the weather. So I can think of a variety of examples, but for some reason, the one that comes to mind is every season, you know, October, November, four or five people call up and they want to know if it's going to be a good snow year. And I have no idea if it's going to be a good snow year. So I just say it's going to snow somewhere.
Yeah. At that point, we're looking at long range projections that are really pretty general, right?
They're so general. And especially like right now, I live in the Pacific Northwest, and the difference between 1 degree is the difference between a season, you know, 1 degree on average is the difference between a pretty tough season and a bumper crop season. And so I think, yes, we should all be very, long range projections are useful and they're important and they're interesting, but like, let's put them in the bucket they deserve to be in, which is, like you say, very general. And they're just based on models.
Yeah. And like you said, even in a specific storm, that snow level, I mean, the models are getting better and better, but like you said, 1 degree is the difference between a cold rain and 12 inches of snow, you know? So it's hard even on the forecasting the next week sometimes to pinpoint that, right?
Absolutely. And I think like for folks listening to this, the take home point is, and I think I might've said this earlier today, but the weather is the architect of the snowpack. So weather builds avalanches, weather builds avalanche conditions, and weather also heals avalanche conditions. And so what's happening around you and what's happening in the environment, plays a direct role in avalanche hazard day in and day out. And so it's fun and it's dynamic Every day is different.
Simon, as we wrap up the weathered wisdom part of the podcast, I wanted to ask you, like, can you think of situations that just blindsided you? I mean, a lot of my background in extreme weather work is with hurricanes, and still almost every year something happens and I'm just like, I didn't even know that was possible, or I never would have thought that would happen. I mean, it seems like Mother Nature has a way to blindside us, even the experts. I mean, does anything stand out to you that, you know, an avalanche or something that happened that you're like, you just wouldn't have quite thought it would be that way, maybe?
All the time. And everything from, you know, I have a really good friend and colleague that I work with right now who long time ago, he said, never, ever underestimate the ability for a hell of a lot of, I think he used an expletive, I won't use it, but a hell of a lot of new snow to do absolutely nothing, meaning not cause any avalanche problems, which is counterintuitive. Sometimes we think, oh my God, it snowed 4 feet. There's going to be avalanches everywhere. And sometimes there's not. There's no recipe. It's not there. It does nothing. And the counterpoint is also true. Every now and then you get what we call the angry inch, and every path that you can see avalanches for some reason. And you're just not quite sure what it was that tipped the scale.
Wow. So you're saying like just getting a big dump of snow doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get mega avalanches. It's just, it's really a nuanced and case by case, right?
It's quite nuanced. And in general, yes, if you're getting a lot of snow and a lot of wind and the weather is just terrible, you're probably going to see some avalanches, but not always. And that's why we have jobs.
Yeah, right. Well,
and I would like to say we're always right, but we're not.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You said that's why we have jobs. I am so impressed by the work that you all do. And I think I've learned a lot about the importance of this work. A few years ago, I went out to Lake Tahoe area, Tahoe Palisades in the wintertime. And I used to picture avalanches. I mean, I lived in Alaska for 3 years. I grew up in the Eastern Great Lakes, big snow winters, but not a lot of avalanches. But I'm used to being around winter. I was a winter sports athlete. I still had this picture that avalanches are really a backcountry thing. It's the backcountry skier, backcountry snowboarder, but it's not really impacting the built environment. I got out to Tahoe Palisades and came across this apartment complex that just got leveled by this avalanche. Jeremiah, I think we have a few of these photographs to pull up. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this, but an avalanche came, you know, just roaring down this mountain, impacting the first two levels. And it just, for me, was like, whoa, like that. Again, we talk about being blindsided. I never pictured an avalanche really impacting the built environment like that. And I wanted to ask you, Simon, like, so how do communities consider avalanche risk, or maybe plan like where to build and where not to, or even for transportation routes? I mean, this can really impact a lot of people when these avalanches, you know, reach a populated area, right?
Oh, absolutely. And luckily in the United States, most of our built environments are not directly in the mountains or directly threatened by avalanches, as opposed to areas in Europe where entire towns are in what could be considered active avalanche terrain. But we do have some places in the U.S., like you mentioned, you know, places around Lake Tahoe, places around Sun Valley, Idaho, places Missoula, Montana, Juneau, Alaska. There are a handful of communities that are threatened by avalanches every season. And most generally, at the community level, it's a county decision, and deal with it through zoning. Those laws are very diverse depending on where you live. Some places are more robust than others. On our roadways, if you think of our big mountain passes, those roads wouldn't be open, most of them, in the wintertime if you didn't have teams of avalanche professionals that are up there creating avalanches, getting them out of the way so that the roads can remain open safely. On a day-to-day basis. Same goes with ski areas. Like most big ski areas in the West wouldn't even open in the wintertime. We wouldn't be able to do it safely if you didn't have teams that go through there before the public comes out. And they knock all the avalanches down. They start the avalanches so that we don't. And they are incredibly important in mountainous landscapes. And, you know, from biology, watershed resources to habitation, transportation, they do have an effect. And yeah, it's just a super fun phenomenon to work with.
Okay, Simon, this is fascinating. You talked about teams intentionally knocking down avalanches, getting that snow down the mountain at times before the people are out there. How in the world do they do that?
There's a variety of ways that they generally use some sort of explosive device, or they use their own skis. But there's you know, procedures and protocols for both. But at the end of the day, what people need to remember is that people are going out there early in the morning, and they're hunting avalanches and they're starting avalanches so that we can go have fun on the landscape. And these are in areas, roadways and ski areas, to be clear. Like, nobody's doing this work in the backcountry, which is why it's so important to have the forecast and the information about the conditions.
Wow, amazing. I mean, it seems like so many resources are going into understanding where the snow is, what the conditions are the snow are, and just like you said on that national map at avalanche.org, just making a map so people can see those hazards. Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. As we wrap up, what's one last thought you'd like to share with our listeners?
That's interesting, because your last comment triggered a thought that I think is really important, which is, you know, thinking back to this interview, it may seem like there are a lot of resources going to this, but they're actually, in the big scheme of thing, there's not. So we run these programs, at least in the backcountry side of things, for less than $10 million a year. And about half of that money comes from the U.S. government, and the rest of it comes from communities and states. And so every avalanche center on the landscape, if you go to avalanche.org, you can see where they're all at. They're all public-private partnerships, and they are generally operated by the Forest Service. Unless you live in Colorado, they're operated by the state. But both agencies use private dollars, meaning community fundraising, to get the work done. And neither agency is I wouldn't say we're bootstrapped, and we're highly efficient, and we work incredibly in an incredibly lean fashion. But so if you think about, you know, last year nationwide, we probably did around 12,000 avalanche forecasts, daily forecasts in one season. And there are about, like I said earlier, 85 to 90 people working on it. And we're doing all that work for, you know, less than $10 million. And it's remarkable. And we have dropped the fatality rate in the United States. The avalanche fatality rate is actually flatlined over the last 20 years, which is really neat. There's still too many people dying, but at a time when exposure has increased at an orders of magnitude, probably, we see the same number of people, the same average of people getting killed and hurt each year. And so we're having a lot of success. And the main point, to your point, it's a small program with a really big reach and a really big footprint. So it's fun.
Well, that's it. And my bad for assuming that this is highly funded. I was so impressed when I went to the national map and I started drilling down. And when you look at the detailed resolution, I mean, like, it looks so detailed. And then the forecasts are extremely comprehensive. And I'm like, whoa, this is like this whole huge thing. Y'all are doing a lot with a little bit of money then, because I was really impressed and I could see how people could just use this information right away to plan their trip and to help them out. So kudos to you, your team, and you know, everyone working in that sector to really help educate and prepare people for avalanches.
Well, thanks. You know, we do it because we love it. People really like their jobs. So,
well, I could tell that. And you know, I could tell for you, snow is a passion. Getting outdoors and enjoying snow sports is a passion. And you and your team are helping people keep a lot of people safe when they want to get out there and just enjoy the outdoors in the wintertime.
Thanks.
Simon, thanks so much for taking time to come in the GeoTrek podcast. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun. Appreciate it.
On this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, Simon Troutman shared about the physical processes that generate avalanches, what we can do to protect ourselves in avalanche-prone areas, and some things communities are doing to plan better to reduce the impacts of avalanches. Something that really stood out to me on this podcast is the importance of considering our settings when engaging with environmental education. Simon mentioned that avalanche professionals were able to engage in effective education in Cook City, Montana, because there was only one way into that community, and educators could engage with snowmobilers at a few specific locations, like cooperative hotels. This reminds us to consider settings and partnerships when educating for any hazard, whether relating to avalanches, hurricanes, or tornadoes. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the GeoTrek podcast. If you enjoyed the journey, don't forget to follow the podcast and leave us a review. It helps more adventurers like you to find the show.